From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. Robin's off this week. News today that American warplanes began attacking ISIS targets in Libya. The Pentagon says the strikes come at the request of the fledgling government attempting to form in Libya.
And we'll continue to follow that story. But meanwhile, the dispute between Donald Trump and the parents of a fallen Muslim American soldier continued today after the couple criticized Trump at the DNC. While Khizr Khan and his wife Ghazala were speaking on CNN this morning, Trump tweeted, "Mr. Khan, who does not know me, viciously attacked me from the stage of the DNC and is now all over TV doing the same. Nice." Asked to respond, Khan said this.
"I really want to maintain mine and my family's dignity. I spoke what was appropriate. And if he's watching, just imagine there was no need to comment."
In a statement this morning, Republican Senator John McCain said the Republican nomination does not give Trump unfettered license to defame those who are the best among us. Joining us right now, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And you have not yet commented publicly on this. What do you think?
Well, it's just another one in a long line of very inappropriate statements that the Republican nominee has made. And it seems to be consistent with what he said before about other groups.
What do you think of what he has been saying on Twitter in response to Mr. Khan and Mrs. Khan speaking out in interviews? Like one of the tweets this morning was, "This story is not about Mr. Khan, who is all over the place doing interviews, but rather radical Islamic terrorism and the U.S. Get smart."
Well, I don't think that's what it's about at all. Here's a man who lost a son. And feels that that Mr. Trump isn't where he should be, and is expressing his right to criticize the nominee. Every nominee for office, whether it's a president or Senate or House, will undergo some criticism. But to respond the way that Donald Trump has responded is completely inappropriate.
The Khans have also called on other Republicans to do what you're doing and to denounce what Trump has said about this. Do you think that you've heard enough of that from your fellow Republicans? Do you want to hear more from Speaker Ryan or Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, or even Trump's running mate, Mike Pence, who I know you're very fond of?
Well, I'm not going to go through and try to search out what everybody has said. If we were required to distance ourselves from every comment that Donald Trump makes, that would consume much of our time. And there is, I think, appropriately, a lot of outrage out there.
There was an extensive statement from your fellow Arizona Republican Senator John McCain today. Now, John McCain will remember about a year ago, Trump went after McCain, saying that he liked people who weren't captured in war, which drew a lot of outrage, but in the end didn't stop Donald Trump's march to the nomination. Do you think that this one is going to be like that and like many others, and it really is not going to offend the people who are supporting Donald Trump?
Well, I think in the end, it will matter. And I've said before, I don't believe that Donald Trump can win if he continues to say the things that he has said. I don't think that he should win if he continues to say the things that he said. He's got to change directions. It's growing a little late in the game for him to do so. But hope springs eternal.
Well, if you say you don't think that he should win if he said the things that he said, why have you also said that you're not going to vote for the person who's running against him, Hillary Clinton?
Well, there will be other people on the ballot, and you could have the opportunity to write somebody in as well. You know, people like me are in a tough spot. Obviously, we don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. We know her record. A lot of us, you know, don't want to go that direction, but cannot see voting for a man who continues to make the kind of statements that he's made and also espouse the kind of positions that he's taken.
There was a big article about you in Politico the other day that you're in some sort of political purgatory right now because you've spoken out so much against Donald Trump. Are you worried if he becomes president that you're going to be kind of persona non grata in Washington?
No, I'm not. I don't worry about that. He's going to do what he's going to do, and I just have to do what I have to do.
Have you gotten threats of retribution from the Trump campaign?
Nothing that hasn't been said publicly. Hmm. In the meeting in the Senate, he did mention that he would work against me.
So what would you like to see now, Senator Flake? How do we move past this moment in the campaign?
Well, I would hope that he would come out and just say, I'm sorry. The statements I've made against this man and his family are inappropriate. I shouldn't have made them. I'm going to move on. He has never apologized to John McCain for that statement or to other POWs or people who were captured, people that simply won't admit that they've made a mistake and move on. There's something wrong there. And then going forward, I hope that he reconsiders a number of the positions he's taken. Like I said, it's not just the words he's spoken, it's the positions with regard to NATO, with regard to immigration reform, with regard to the Muslim ban. These are positions that need to change as well. He seems to walk back at times on certain positions, but then sometimes goes right back to where he was. And so I think that a number of things has to change, both if he wants to win and if he should win and assume that office.
That's Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona. Senator, thanks so much for joining us once again.
You bet.
Well, Chicago is welcoming its first presidential library. President Obama's library will be built in his adopted hometown of Chicago in the city's south side. The Obamas still have a home in the neighborhood. Joining us by Skype is Blair Kamen, architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune. Blair, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
So the library is going in at Jackson Park. For those of us who don't know the area, tell us about it.
Well, Jackson Park is a 540-plus acre park. It's right along the shore of Lake Michigan. It was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, a great 19th century landscape architect who also did Boston's Emerald Necklace in New York Central Park. Mm-hmm. One of the prime features in the park is the Museum of Science and Industry, and that is a survivor of the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. That was a great World's Fair that introduced the first Ferris wheel and many other innovations. So it's a very historic site.
And what's left of the World's Columbian Exposition from 1893 today?
Not much. Really, the park right now is, it has a lagoon, a wooded island with an Osaka garden on it. It's a bucolic park, and it kind of screams out, you know, put your presidential library here in me, because I am a kind of, you know, conventional setting where a president might want to build his or her architectural monument. And yet it's unconventional in the sense that just to the west of this park, I should say, is a neighborhood called Woodlawn. It is a poor and predominantly African-American neighborhood. It is very unusual for a presidential library to go in such a location.
So the choice has some people upset from other neighborhoods that didn't get the nod. I mean, there was another Southside location under consideration, Washington Park. Tell us why that was not picked.
Well, we don't know exactly, but it's further west. It's off the lakefront. It's uncharted territory for many tourists and people from the suburbs, global visitors. So it's fair to say that the Obamas picked a somewhat safer choice.
Mm. And Frederick Law Olmsted had a 19th century romantic sort of bucolic vision. Does that work for a presidential library there in the park?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether the architects, the husband and wife team from New York, Todd Williams and Billy Chen, are able to insert a presidential library into this park without making the park feel crammed. Interestingly enough, during the World's Fair of 1893, there was a very large building, the horticultural building of the World's Fair. That was a long linear building, almost 1,000 feet long, lots of greenhouses in it, a spectacular dome of glass, 114 feet high. So in a way, they have a precedent to work with on the site. But we'll see whether they can make kind of a synthesis between the natural and the man-made. That is going to be their prime challenge.
Blair, this is the first presidential library in the city and a win for Chicago after a couple of architectural losses. It didn't get the Olympics, and filmmaker George Lucas recently canceled plans to put his museum there. How are Chicagoans looking at this?
I think, by and large, people are very pleased about this. The Obama Library is really seen as both an honor and an economic catalyst. It is something that should be able to spread the wealth of the city's cultural institutions south to areas that have long suffered from, you know, a lack of investment and other factors that really prevented them from becoming thriving neighborhoods. There's also great concern about gentrification. In other words, the very thing that could uplift the neighborhood economically could also raise rents and property taxes and drive people out. And that would be a great irony, of course, because Barack Obama began his career as a community organizer here in Chicago.
Yeah, the South Side could get a huge economic boost, but at what cost? Blair Kamen is the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune. Blair, thank you for speaking with us.
Eric, it was my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
And the 2016 Summer Olympics begin on Friday with the opening ceremonies. And we've heard a lot about the current state of the host country, Brazil. Problems with Zika, corruption, and readiness for the Games. But we wanted to take a step back right now and talk about how Brazil became what it is. A short history of the country. Joining us now is Brody Fisher, who's a history professor at the University of Chicago and director of the Center for Latin American Studies there. Brody Fisher, thanks for joining us. And let's go back to the beginning of modern day Brazil. When and how did the Portuguese settle there, and who did they find?
All right, so this takes us back more than 500 years to 1500, when a Portuguese semi-nobleman named Pedro Álvares Cabral tried to duplicate a voyage that had been undertaken a couple years before to India. And sort of semi-accidentally, he went a little bit too far to the west, and he came across what we now know as Brazil. He stayed for only 10 days, but he took that time to claim the entire landmass for the Portuguese crown. The problem was that although there was actually a lot in what's now Brazil, there were millions of indigenous peoples, four major language groups, plenty of resources, as we would learn later. The Portuguese actually didn't see any of that. And so for them, it was pretty much a whole lot of nothing. They didn't find the gold and silver they wanted. There was no empire to take over like there had been in, or would be in Mexico and Peru. And so they just kind of laid claim and sent some expeditions, but nothing really happened for about 50 years after that initial claim.
You mentioned the indigenous people. What happened to them? And we do know that even today, occasionally, people find tribes in the Amazon that have little or no contact with the outside world.
Absolutely. So the indigenous people of Brazil were different than the ones that were colonized by the Spanish. They were really dispersed. They were in kind of semi-nomadic villages that would stay in one place for an agricultural cycle or several and then move on someplace else. And so with the arrival of the Europeans, they were hit terribly by smallpox and other European diseases. Mortality was as high as 90% in most of the Americas. But because Brazil's landmass is so enormous and because the Portuguese really didn't get beyond the coast for several centuries, many of them just simply went further west and managed to keep on their own language, their own religion, their own traditions in the Brazilian interior for centuries after the Portuguese laid claim.
So how did the country grow? What were the major industries that developed during colonization?
So one funny story about Brazil is that its name actually comes from a commodity. There was a kind of tree in Brazil that they called pau-brasil, which had a dye that was used in European textile industries. And so the very first thing that Brazil exported were these enormous tree trunks. And then the country got its name from pau-brasil, from the name of from this tree. And that was kind of appropriate because for centuries, Brazil has depended on one commodity cycle after another. After Brazil wood, which was kind of a minor one, the first major one was sugar. Brazil was the first place in the world that brought together the kind of terrible but enormously profitable combination of European technology, sugarcane, fertile soil of Brazil, and slave labor. So by the second half of the 16th century, Brazil became the first major sugar producer in the world. And for about a century, between 1550 and 1650, Brazil's first fortunes were made on the basis of sugar and slavery. Then in the middle of the 17th century, the Dutch actually took all of those technologies to the Caribbean, and the Caribbean would overcome Brazil as a producer of sugar. And so Brazil saw its first great bust. But in the wake of that, there were these legacies that would be really important for Brazil's economic history. The first was, of course, slavery. A lot of your listeners might not know that we often think in the United States of African-American slavery as being something that was centered in our own country. But there were actually under about 400,000 Africans who were forcibly brought to what's now the United States, and almost 11 million in the Americas. And of those 11 million, 5 million went to Brazil. So Brazil is by far the largest destination for forced African labor anywhere in the world. And
how long did that last? When did slavery end in Brazil?
Brazil was the very last country in the world, in the Western Hemisphere, to eliminate slavery in 1888. And so when I've done research in my own historical work in Rio, I've actually talked to the grandchildren of slaves who remember their grandparents talking about being slaves. It's that close generationally to the present.
We're speaking with Brody Fisher, who is a history professor at the University of Chicago and director of the Center for Latin American Studies there, about Brazil and its history as we prepare for the Olympics in Rio. And Brody Fisher, I want to ask you about the huge cities that have developed in Brazil, these multi-millions of people living in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. How did these enormous cities develop and why did they get to be so big?
So to understand why cities grow, I have to tell you just a couple things about Brazil's history since 1500, because otherwise it won't make all that much sense. Brazil was a colony until the early 1820s, and it had a very peaceful transition to independence, much more peaceful than the United States or the rest of Latin America. And then for most of the 19th century, it was an empire that was sustained by another commodity, coffee, and by a really hierarchical social order and very concentrated resources. But in 1888, with the abolition of slavery, that empire ended, and Brazil turned for the first time to a republican system of government. And with that came all kinds of pressures to transform and modernize the Brazilian economy. It took more or less 40 years for those pressures to get strong enough that change happened very quickly. But by the time you get to the 1930s and 40s, Brazil embarked on the most ambitious program of economic development and change of any Latin American country. And in fact, by the end of the 20th century, it would have gone from a completely rural country to the largest industrial producer in Latin America. And so the growth of cities had to do with all of those processes, because like everywhere in the world, cities are understood as places of opportunity. But the kind of opportunity that Brazilian cities gave was a little bit different than what you might imagine in Detroit or Chicago or industrial England, because what people wanted were not so much industrial jobs. They also wanted citizenship, and they wanted freedom from these kind of rural power structures that had kept people under the thumb of rural bosses for centuries and that hadn't changed all that much with slavery. And so people went to cities to find versions of freedom and citizenship and access to public resources that they could just never have in the Brazilian countryside. And the reason that all that really matters in terms of the way that cities are in Brazil is that when you have so many people coming at once to these urban areas, I mean, growth rates are sometimes, you know, 5-6% per year in these larger cities. It's almost impossible for either jobs or infrastructure to keep up with all those people. Yeah. And so what you see is people who create their own worlds. They create their own housing, Brazil's famous favelas, which start in Rio at the end of the 19th century.
And these are poor neighborhoods that often go right up the hills next to the city.
Exactly. And they started out, actually, a lot of them as kind of continuations of tenements that had existed in the old city. But very quickly, they became these places where migrants could basically live for less than they could in any part of the formal city. And at the same time, people would create informal economies. And so what you have is a city that is growing almost more quickly in its informal sectors than it is in its formal sectors. It's as if our cities had the majority of their population living as undocumented migrants, essentially.
What do outsiders misunderstand about Brazil? I have to say, I went there in 2005 or 6, and it was such a different place, even than I imagined it would be. The people, the music, the food, just the culture was, it was so different than Argentina, for example. What do people misunderstand about Brazil?
So I think the main thing that I would say is that we often tend to understand places like Brazil through the lens of the latest emergency or crisis. And so, you know, now we hear about Zika and everyone panics, and you hear about the corruption scandal and the impeachment of the president. And you get the impression that this is a place where everyone's constantly rioting in the streets and unstable. But in fact, Brazil is one of the largest economies in the world. It's an incredible success story in terms of creating an end to the worst forms of extreme poverty that were part of the country up through the middle of the 20th century and even into the end of it. It has incredibly innovative forms of democracy and forms of legislation. Brazil's relationship with race relations is just fascinating for people in the United States, because although it's a racist country and certainly race and class are correlated in all kinds of ways that you don't want, they also think about racial categories in really different ways than we do here, and relationships across races are much easier in some ways. There's just a lot of things to really love about Brazil, and especially when you get into the cultural realm with the music and the food and the language. It's a place to admire and to learn from. And so it's really a terrible shame that these Olympics, which are showcasing Brazil, are coming at such a time of crisis for the country, because the crisis is a moment, but the country is a civilization. And hopefully they'll find a way to show that to the world, despite all of the problems that everybody's hearing so much about.
That's Brody Fisher, a history professor at the University of Chicago and the director of the Center for Latin American Studies there. Brody Fisher, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are looking into the cause of this weekend's hot air balloon accident in Central Texas. The crash killed all 16 people on board. It's been called the worst balloon accident in U.S. history, and it's putting the spotlight on whether the Federal Aviation Administration should impose tighter safety restrictions on commercial hot air balloon operators. John Burnett is NPR's Southwest correspondent. He's with us now from Austin. John, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hey, Eric.
So, John, you were at the scene of the crash this weekend, and you spoke with investigators. Can you tell us the latest on the investigation?
Well, the big question is really, why did this huge balloon hit these very tall, high-voltage power lines that that go across this, you know, Central Texas cropland? Presumably, the gondola burst into flames when it hit these high power lines, and the pictures from the news helicopters showed that the basket was just incinerated with the poor people inside, presumably 15 passengers and the pilot. The power lines have been there for years. They're like 15 stories tall, and the pilot lived about 10 miles away. I actually went to his house, and so he knew the route. So really, the questions are, why didn't this big balloon, why wasn't it able to clear those lines? Was it weather? Was it pilot error? Was it an equipment malfunction? They'll look at the FAA flightworthiness certificate for the balloon, and they're sure going to talk to the ground crew, the chase crew, and any possible witnesses.
This isn't the NTSB's usual kind of investigation, I gather. I mean, are there other challenges here, John?
Well, you know, it's tough because there are no survivors and there's no flight data recorder in balloons, and they don't know if they're we don't know if they're eyewitnesses yet. But on the other hand, it's generally easier than an airplane crash. You don't have wreckage that's spread out for miles. All the bodies are in one place. And there's not as many things that can go wrong in a hot air balloon, certainly compared to an aircraft. We know the NTSB has recovered 14 personal electronic devices, cell phones and cameras. And so if they're still operable, not burned too bad, they'll try to get inside those and analyze the images and see what the passengers saw before this horrific accident.
John, do we know much about the people who were killed on board?
Well, we mainly know about the pilot. His name is Skip Nichols. He's 49 years old. He was the owner and the main balloon pilot at Heart of Texas Balloon Rides. You know, in published interviews, friends have said he's very experienced, he's safety conscious, but some really troubling things have emerged in the last 24 hours about him. He had a driving while intoxicated charge in 2000 in Missouri. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported in 2008 that he had a balloon company in Missouri in those days. It got an unsatisfactory record from the Better Business Bureau because it didn't respond to customer complaints. And he was on probation in Missouri for dealing drugs. So, again, investigators are going to Once they identify his body, we assume the coroner will look for the presence of drugs in his system, and they'll surely look at his pilot certificate to see if he revealed some of these Missouri charges to the FAA when they gave him a pilot's license.
John, hot air balloons are technically considered aircraft. Briefly, what kind of safety regulations are there, and should there be more?
Well, you know, the NTSB wrote this letter in 2014 saying that they had real concerns about balloons carrying so many passengers and being so unregulated, far less regulated than, you know, than helicopters and aircraft. And so there was an aviation attorney I talked to this morning. He said, we saw this thing coming.
John Burnett is NPR's Southwest correspondent. Thank you, John.
The National Park Service turns 100 years old this month. So this summer, we're taking a tour of some of the country's national parks. Today, Florida's Everglades National Park. And joining us now is Alan Scott, who's the Chief of Resource Education and Interpretation at the park. He's with us via Skype. Alan, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. And for people who have never met this park, who have never been to Everglades National Park, describe it for us.
Everglades National Park is at the southern tip of Florida. And if you're not from this area, it's hard to comprehend. It's sort of a mix of environments between the Caribbean and North America. And the park was really established for what's alive, plants and animals. And it's a great place to experience wildlife.
And there is a lot of wildlife there. So tell us some of the different animals that you can find in the park.
So some of the wildlife that you can see in Everglades National Park is alligators. All of South Florida is known for that. But we have trails that go into alligator habitat. And the wildlife in Everglades National Park is not fed, is not hunted. And they were born and raised with people walking by. So you can see them in their natural environment behaving like they would in nature. And they basically ignore us. And I like to say that some of our trails are like a National Geographic special every day. You don't have to look for hours for wildlife. You just walk a few minutes down a trail and you can see birds and fish and turtles, different kinds of butterflies and alligators.
You know, I've been many times to Everglades National Park and have driven through on the way from the eastern part of Florida to the western part of Florida and back. And one of the things I must say that you notice there immediately are the birds, and there are a lot of them. Tell us about some of the interesting birds that you have.
So one of the types of animals that Everglades is most famous for is birds, specifically wading birds. And there are egrets and herons and wood storks. There are birds called roseate spoonbills. There are shore birds that you would call seagulls. The reason that birds are in this area is because of the diverse habitats and the mix of freshwater and saltwater in the Everglades that creates a great food source. And the other aspect of it is that we have a seasonal cycle of flooding, and then we have a dry season in the winter that concentrates the fish, and that's what has really attracted the birds to the Everglades, is because when the fish are concentrated, it's easy for them to catch the fish and then raise their young.
You know, one of the animals that we haven't talked about in the park is the panther, right? The Florida panther.
The Florida panther is one of our endangered species. It's a huge cat. If you ever see one, they can be 8 or 9 feet long from tip of nose to tip of tail. It's a big animal. So we have a Florida panther population that we like to say is around a dozen animals. And the park is right next to Big Cypress National Preserve. And that is right next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. So South Florida is one of the best habitats for the Florida panther.
Well, how did the Everglades National Park become a national park?
Everglades National Park was the first national park in the United States that was set aside as a national park because what's alive, the plants and the animals, and the ecosystems that support those plants and animals. Today we know the Everglades as a river of grass. But that term was coined by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in 1947, only the same year that the park was established. Prior to that, people didn't really understand that it was a river, and they saw what was wetlands, known as Everglades, as worthless land to be developed. And so a lot of the Everglades had been drained and developed prior to the park being established. Something else that happened is at the turn of the 1800s to the 1900s, that period of time, there was a fashion for women to wear feathers in their hats. And the feathers are plumes from birds that were nesting in the Everglades and other wetlands around the world. And the time that people hunted for those feathers was when those birds were on their nest with their chicks. And so they would go, the hunters would go kill the adult birds for their plume feathers that they had because they were in breeding season. And so those population of wading birds were nearly wiped out. And that brought a lot of attention to the area that is now in Everglades National Park.
Now, of course, the Everglades National Park is in the Everglades, which is in the middle of a lot of development in South Florida. How has all the development affected the park? Because we know that in the Everglades more broadly, the roads that have been built over the many decades to cut across Florida are a problem because they stop the flow of water. But what about the development in general for the park?
One of the unique aspects about Everglades National Park is it's a natural area. It was set aside to preserve the plants and the animals in this area, and it relies on the flow of fresh water. And Everglades National Park is actually really big. It's 1,500,000 acres. But within 50 miles of that park, there are almost 7 million people living next to it. So it's an amazing mix or juxtaposition of people and wilderness side by side. The development around the park manages the water, and it manages the water to keep what used to be wetlands dry for development purposes. And it also manages the water to hold water for water supply for the people in South Florida, because the water that's in the Everglades is also the water supply for the people of South Florida. And there are roads and there are water management structures that manage all this water for the people and for the natural system. One of the roads on the Northern Park boundary is the Tamiami Trail. And as part of the Everglades restoration efforts, we have worked with the state of Florida and with many other agencies to add bridging across that trail that would allow more water to go into the park in the right places and the right amount at the right time. And in this last year, we've tested that with our first new bridge and has been very successful, adding water back into the Everglades within Everglades National Park.
How long have you been working in the Everglades?
I've been working in the Everglades for about 25 years.
Wow. And what's your favorite thing to do in the park after all that time?
So one of the things that I like to do the most, that most people don't like to do, is go walking in the water off the road and off the trail, and we call that sluice logging. And so you walk out in the water more than ankle up to knee deep, and you're out there standing in an open prairie where you can see from horizon to horizon Everglades.
And you don't have to worry about alligators?
Well, there are alligators and lots of other animals in that water. However, those animals are very much afraid of us for the most part when you get into their habitat like that. And so they tend to leave. But you can have really amazing experiences by getting out and being personal with the Everglades like that. But there are other activities that are easy to do. There's an area of the park called Snake Bite, spelled B-I-G-H-T. That's a bay next to an area called Flamingo, and it's terrific to take a canoe out of Flamingo. It's a short half an hour paddle to an area called Snake Bite, and the bird watching and the wildlife watching is just amazing.
Well, Alan Scott, park ranger at Everglades National Park in Florida, thank you so much for joining us, and stay safe in the water, please.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
And we will be broadcasting from a national park later this month for the 100th anniversary of the Park Service. I'm not going to tell you which one right now, but it will be historic as long as the technology works from where we will be. So stay tuned for that and send us your photos from your visits to the national parks. You can tweet at me at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter. That's at Jeremy Hobson.
There's new evidence that playing a very specific type of computer game, one associated with a skill called speed of processing training, could cut the risk of developing dementia in 10 years later by up to 48%. That's right, by nearly half. The results of a new study show that speed training, unlike memory training or reasoning exercises, can help stave off mental decline. The study was presented recently at this year's Alzheimer's Association conference in Toronto. The lead researcher was Dr. Jerry Edwards, an associate professor in the School of Aging at Florida State University in Tampa. She joins us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Dr. Edwards, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So start by telling us a little bit about the study. What were you looking for and how did you do it?
Well, this is a very large study that was supported by the National Institutes of Health that began about 20 years ago. It's called the ACTIVE study. The goal was to compare three different kinds of cognitive training to see if those techniques could enhance older adults' cognitive and everyday functional abilities.
And now the results. Tell us what you found.
Well, our most recent results were that over 10 years, that those who completed a very specific form of cognitive training, which we call speed of processing training, were less likely to develop dementia over 10 years.
Well, tell us a little about what people would be doing in these exercises. What would they see on screen during speed training?
Speed of processing training is a computerized training program that targets visual attention and mental quickness. So we show visual targets on the screen that you have to identify and localize, and the display speeds are very, very brief. And we work at increasing the amount of information that you can process over very brief periods of time, matters of milliseconds.
So 48%, I mean, that's huge. Were you surprised by these results?
No, I was not.
Why?
Because in 2002, in one of the first randomized clinical trials that we did of this training program, we found that it improved older adults' everyday functional abilities. And we replicated that in 2005. It has since been shown in more than four randomized clinical trials that older adults' everyday functional abilities are improved after doing this training. So dementia, by definition, involves functional impairment. So it just makes sense that if we're improving older adults' everyday functional performance, that over time we would be delaying the onset of dementia. And so we finally had compelling data to show that that's the case.
The exercises you used were developed by a company called Posit Science in 2007. We should say that you worked for them analyzing data for a few months 8 years ago, but you have no current ties to them. Is that correct?
Actually, the training exercise was developed by Dr. Carlene Ball and Daniel Bronker, who were my mentors. And Posit Science acquired the rights to the program in 2007. So I did work as a consultant to them for a few months in 2008. Thankfully, someone helped pay me during the summer. But I do not have any financial interest in this training program.
We should note there was some hype a few years ago about another computer game and dementia. The Federal Trade Commission settled a $2 million lawsuit against Lumos Labs, saying the company made false claims about their games. Can you tell us how this game is different from memory and reasoning games?
So the speed of processing training is different from memory and reasoning training because it doesn't teach explicit strategies. So memory training teaches you mnemonics in order to help you remember things. Reasoning training teaches you strategies to help you recognize patterns to solve problems. But speed of processing training is a computerized program of visual attention that is aimed at improving your processing speed and particularly your performance on a test called Useful Field of View Performance, UFOV for short. And UFOV is a well-known predictor of driving among older adults, and this test has been well researched for many years. And this training program specifically targets your UFOV performance. And it was shown that those randomized to speed of processing training were still performing significantly better on the UFOV test 10 years later.
So Dr. Edwards, who do you recommend uses these exercises?
Well, I think first of all, it's important to know that you need to do the exercises long before you think you need to. So our brains start to slow down as early as 25 years of age. So if you're 50 years old, you've already experienced 25 years of decline on average. But it's not something that we notice. So I believe that anyone who is 50 should use the program. And if you're having problems before 50, then I think you should use it earlier. My husband uses it. My family uses it.
After consulting a physician or just at 50, you should start doing these?
You know, it's a computerized cognitive training program. It has minimal to no risks. And our research has shown over multiple clinical trials that it has a number of benefits.
Dr. Jerry Edwards, happy gaming. She's an associate professor in the School of Aging Studies at the University of South Florida. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, keep up your speed of processing training. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.